Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina's most recently passed budget was a long time coming, and this 634-page, $34 billion budget is more than just bottom-line figures. It contains many provisions that have little to do with money. One aspect of the budget we focused on in recent programs are those bottom-line figures when it comes to pay raises and bonuses and how this budget impacts public education. But it also affects higher education in many different ways, and that is what we're going to talk about today with Corey Dean, higher education reporter at the Assembly, and Kate Denning, who focuses on education issues as a writer for Carolina Public Press. Thank you both for being with us. Good morning. Corey, I'm going to begin with you and the key provisions of this budget when it comes to higher education. The UNC system had what you called as their top priority, fully funded, $153.8 million for enrollment growth. Was that unexpected or merely on hold because it took so long for this budget to pass?
It was on hold for a long time, for, you know, the 2 years that it took to get the budget. Enrollment funding, enrollment growth funding is what the name sounds like. It is money that funds, you know, student credit hours, how much, how many students these universities are educating. And it is very complex, the formula that is used to allocate this. So I will not go into all of that. But essentially, it's an additional allocation on top of just the base funding that universities get. So it's not like they were operating with no money at all for the past 2 years. Right. But it does help fund the actual academic mission of the university, you know, students in classrooms, all of that. And, you know, it was a lot of money that the universities were going without for that amount of time. So I think it was, I think there was a big hope that they would get it, and they did.
So the base funding is, I think, $5.03 billion for the UNC system overall. This $153.8 million is in addition to that. Were they going without while we waited for the budget, or were they going at outdated numbers while we waited for the budget?
My understanding is they went without because I believe it's a non-recurring allocation. You'd have to double check me on that, but I believe that's how it works. And so, yeah, they were going without, and essentially it's funded in arrears. So the money this year will fund essentially last year's freshman class. So, you know, if you're growing your enrollment every year and you're not getting the money, it becomes harder to actually do your job as a university.
And they are growing their enrollment. The UNC system experienced, I think, record enrollment last fall. Was that at all of their campuses or at select campuses? And do they anticipate steady or increasing enrollment in the next couple of years?
I believe this fall or this past fall, every campus except UNC Asheville saw an increase of some amount. And, you know, UNC Asheville kind of explains that citing Hurricane Helene and some, you know, impacts to their recruitment efforts and campus tours and things that were going on. I think there's hope that the UNC system will continue to see an increase. We are entering or kind of in the middle of what's called the demographic cliff, which is a really plateau and then a fall off in the number of high school students in the or high school seniors. Around the country, the Southeast is a bit different because we actually are growing. So, you know, I think there's the hope that the UNC system will continue to grow. Of course, if other places in the country have fewer students, it kind of increases the competition. So I think they're hopeful but cautious.
So I did a lot of reading about this yesterday because I know just enough about this to be dangerous. You have all the facts, the two of you, you and Kate. But there is, if I read this correctly, there was some question among those who run the UNC system campuses about whether this request for $153.8 million would be met. North Carolina is one of 29 states in the country that rely on some measure, some type of measurement with regard to student enrollment to determine funding. So if that's the case, and this is a recurring investment, why was there some question about whether this funding would be met?
That is a good question. I think there's been some talk at the Board of Governors at the UNC system office level about making sure that legislators understand exactly what enrollment funding is. There's another pot of money called performance funding that is similar but different, that funds campuses based on their ability to like improve graduation rates, to keep student debt low. There was a whole situation with that over the past few years without a state budget, and legislators, at least how this has been described by, the Board of Governors system office, was that there just seemed to be a disconnect in what the system office was asking for and legislators not quite maybe getting the vision. And so the system office actually said, okay, we'll do this ourselves, and the campuses themselves will fund performance funding, which is kind of a interesting scenario. So yeah, I think the system office has tried to like really make their case to legislators about what enrollment funding is and why the campuses need it. And I guess they did that because they got it finally.
So it's $153.8 million based on enrollment. And NC State requested, as I understand it, over $35 million for enrollment growth, while Winston-Salem State requested about $1.4 million. Do these requests now, does the university, that's the question, do these requests go directly to the legislature by campus, or does the university say we need this big sum of money and then the university decides how much these campuses will get?
It is my understanding is that the UNC system itself makes the blanket request, and they probably, they present to the public in Board of Governors meeting materials the breakdown by campus. So I'm sure that legislators get that as well. But it is, the main lobbying for it is done by UNC system officials, kind of as a collective effort.
Which are the biggest campuses? I'm assuming that Chapel Hill and perhaps UNC Charlotte are among the biggest campuses in the system. But which are the ones that are the biggest, and which are the ones that seem to be growing the most? Do we know?
That is a good question. I don't have the numbers off
Okay.
the top of my head.
But you do report that the legislature, quote, specifically prioritizes enrollment funding for credit hours in engineering, nursing, business, and other health and STEM disciplines. Why those fields?
Yeah, I think it probably has to do with just the demand that we're seeing for those, sectors, and ensuring that the universities can help meet the demands that our state is seeing. I would assume that that's the main thing, and those sectors, especially engineering, are probably ones that set students up for a decent life post-graduation. So they probably want to incentivize steering students into a successful post-graduation life.
Corey Dean reports on all this for the Assembly. Kate Denning is also with us. She reports on Education News for Carolina Public Press. And in April, Kate, you reported that while waiting for a budget to be passed, the UNC system issued a report showing that our state has a surplus of jobs, but not enough degrees to match the need. And that report came from an annual workforce alignment review that the university conducted. And you say that the university knew there would be gaps between supply and demand, but they did not know they would be this large. And you go on to say that our state's job growth isn't limited to fields like technology or healthcare, but is distributed across a lot of different sectors and occupations. What does that mean for employers, for graduates, for where the university system should put its emphasis?
Yeah, I mean, the workforce alignment report that the UNC system did was, I think it was interesting to people because, North Carolina, you Charlotte, Raleigh are kind of always at the the top of these lists that we see for best cities to move to and for job growth. So I think that, it wasn't really expected that it was going to be seeing that we actually had, major gaps in some of our areas. One of the areas that was oversupplied of bachelor's degrees was the physical fitness, parks, recreation, and leisure kind of field. And that report states that the system has seen a total 23% decline in bachelor degree completions in that area. So UNC System Schools have actually discontinued six bachelor degree programs in the field since 2021. So that's one of those things I think we saw kind of a major impact there.
So I guess I'm asking if you know, and you may not, whether this survey or the study that the university system did that revealed these gaps align in some way or do not align in some way with what the legislature prioritizes in terms of engineering, nursing, business, and health and STEM disciplines. Are they in alignment or is the legislature off base?
I think they are in alignment. I think, the legislature is right. Both the UNC system and the legislature are right to sort of prioritize the STEM fields. I will say, like, this is something we might get into later, but STEM fields have been impacted by sort of the AI boom and so forth. So, I don't think they're wrong to prioritize those still, but we have seen the STEM fields kind of be impacted by some of these things that they previously hadn't experienced.
And we will get into the AI situation a little while from now. That survey that we're talking about was the first of its kind, and you said that the university intends to conduct it every single year. How might that inform their budget requests in the future? And how might it inform the General Assembly's priorities when it comes to providing that funding?
I imagine it will inform their approach quite a bit. I think by the system doing that research consistently, it's sort of signaling to the legislature that, the UNC system, they're not in the interest of handing out useless degrees, for lack of a better term. They want the UNC, whatever that means to you, I guess. The UNC system, wants to help, aid in the in moving the state forward and in developing the workforce. They don't want to hold the state back in any way, and they want to sort of work with lawmakers in that way.
I'm not sure either of you can answer this question, but it's come up in discussions of higher education of late because of the stress on using universities and colleges as job preparatory programs. In other words, graduating with a degree that will get you a job on the other side and diminishing the importance of degrees that may not, like philosophy or theater or dance or something like that. Where is the focus of the University of North Carolina system? Where is the focus of the legislature in that area, and do they match up? Corey.
I think the focus is on setting up graduates for success after graduation. There was a big return on investment study done a few years ago that the legislature actually required, and it studied graduates and whether they were getting a return on their investment of the money they were paying for their UNC system education. And it found that most students were, making more money than if you just had a high school degree, and most people were getting a return on their investment, I think, within 10 years of graduation.
Is that the right measure?
Well, there's a lot of
Do academics see that as the right measure?
there's a lot of debate as to whether ROI is a good measure. I mean, I think it is hard to argue with students now who have been told their entire lives, go to college, get a degree, make money, get a job, that it doesn't mean something to them. I do think it's not the only measure that should be looked at, and I think faculty have some other ideas of what should be looked at. I will say, within all of this discussion, Peter Hans, who's the president of the UNC system, he also makes a case for the importance of the liberal arts and not just preparing students for the workforce. So I think they're trying to strike a balance there.
But speaking of the workforce, when we come back, we'll talk about the job market for graduates. It's not looking good. We'll find out more about that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're here today with Corey Dean, higher education reporter for the Assembly, and Kate Denning, education reporter for Carolina Public Press. And we're talking about the intersection of this newly passed state budget and the University of North Carolina system, among other things. And Kate, before we get back to other aspects of the budget affecting higher education, let me circle quickly back to what we were just talking about, education and narrowing the gap between graduates that are being turned out by the UNC system with degrees that match employment needs. This comes at a time when graduates across the country are complaining that they cannot find jobs. And as you report, the jobs market for recent graduates has been dubbed the grimmest in years. Is that nation? Are you speaking nationwide, or is that equally true here in North Carolina?
That has been sort of applied to the entire country. But, you know, something that I wanted to look into in my reporting was if we were seeing the same thing in North Carolina. As I mentioned, you know, Raleigh and Charlotte frequently are kind of looked at as areas where, you know, there's lots of job growth specifically for new grads. So I was curious, you know, is that, are we still seeing, you know, the same sort of trends here in North Carolina? And the answer was resoundingly yes. It is still very difficult even here for new graduates to land jobs. Some of the things I found from that were there's actually employer demand for college graduates, like overall, is actually slowing, which is, I think, the opposite of what everyone was told, you know, growing up, go to college and you'll get a job. And that's not necessarily the case anymore.
Why?
Well, one thing is companies are downsizing quietly. We're not seeing kind of large layoffs. I think that's why a lot of people tend to feel like we're not in a recession. We're not in, you know, a hiring slowdown necessarily, because we're not seeing these huge layoffs. But instead, companies are downsizing quietly by simply not hiring new people to fill the jobs whenever people quit or when people retire. You know, instead of posting those jobs for someone else to fill, they just say, kind of see it as an opportunity to cut corners.
Is that due to inflation? Is it due to tariffs? Is it due to new economic policies of the last several years? Or is it due to AI? Is it why?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I think AI definitely plays a part in it. As I mentioned, AI has been disruptive specifically for fields that you know, we didn't necessarily think that it would be, right? Like it's STEM fields, computer science, large, namely computer science, has been really affected by AI and adjacent fields like computer engineering and so forth. So I think AI is definitely part of it. I don't think that can speak to the whole thing though.
So our state's economy reportedly is better than many other places in the country, which means that the jobs outlook for graduates must be bleaker in other areas of the country than it is here. Is that likely to become more bleak with the emergence, the further emergence of AI?
I think that's definitely the feeling. I don't know if I can say for sure that that will happen definitively, but I think there is a sense among, you know, the average American, especially the average new graduate or college student right now, that it will only continue to get worse.
Okay, we're going to come back to that a little bit later on. But as I said in the beginning, this budget that was recently passed and that we've waited now for 2 years to pass in the legislature is not just about money and numbers. There are other things that you might not expect to find in a budget in this document. Among those things, the Protect Campus Survivors Act, which targets sexual misconduct records at state universities. This sounds like, this sounds like it should be a standalone bill. Why is it part of the budget?
Well, it was a standalone bill. Uh-huh. they had tried to, the legislature, it had been introduced, I want to say last year, in March, maybe, as the Campus Survivors Act, solo. And it didn't make it super far. I think it got to like one committee. You know, sometimes they bounce around to different committees, but that didn't even happen. It made it to one committee and kind of just fell off from there, I think. But really, the Protecting Survivors Act was kind of a 5-year-long effort, even though it was introduced last year, and it sort of came out of the 2020 North Carolina Supreme Court ruling in the Daley Tar Heel v. Fult case, which the Supreme Court ruled that sexual misconduct directors were subject to the public records law. And then after that ruling, some people tried to essentially reverse that, which it now is.
Yeah, it's 6 years ago, for people who don't remember, 2020, UNC schools started to release records of students who had been disciplined for sex-related offenses, which followed a 4-year court battle, which put the pitted the state's public records laws against federal law protecting the privacy of educational needs. The courts decided that these records should be released. Now this new state law essentially reverses that. What exactly does it do, Kate?
So it essentially changes the public records law to say that any personally identifiable information about a student's discipline in regards to disciplinary records are not subject to disclosure under the public records law.
So, Corey, in your reporting on this, you point out that Republican State Senator Michael Lee said the intent of the act is to provide survivors, or protect, excuse me, protect survivors of sexual misconduct by ensuring that information which could inadvertently identify them is not subject to release. Has that been a problem over the last 6 years that the court decided against the UNC system and this information was being released? Was that part of the information being released?
So, information about survivors of sexual misconduct or sexual assault was not part of the information that was being released. The names of those students or the people was not being released.
So why the need for this new law?
So, advocates for those survivors say that there have been instances where students were inadvertently identified by releasing information about the perpetrator. So, if you think about maybe a student's friends knew that they were in a relationship with this person who was identified as a perpetrator. Maybe you draw the conclusion that, oh, this student or my friend might have been the victim in that instance. So that was kind of the impetus, I think, for it. And yeah, that's what advocates and Senator Lee said.
So prior to this becoming law as part of the budget, what information what about sexual assault or misconduct was available as part of the public record? What was being released?
So it was typically the name of the perpetrator, the nature of the misconduct that they committed, and any sanctions that the university imposed upon them through their disciplinary process.
But again, not the name of the survivor of sexual misconduct. So, Kate, proponents of the law say this new law protects the survivors. But prior to this becoming law, their information was not part of the release of information. So, how do they justify that?
Yeah, they've pretty much said that any inadvertent information about the perpetrator, could be essentially linked to a survivor. It definitely not everyone sees their line of thinking there, but that is sort of what the lobbyists have said.
So now what will be released? Nothing?
They are able to release aggregated data, guidelines, instructions, or summaries, as they put it in the bill. So, actually, when it was introduced last year as a standalone bill, that was not permitted. It was kind of a lot more sweeping, none of this will be released type of thing. But now, they are allowed to release data that says we had this many instances of sexual misconduct on campus, and where we had this many students who received some sort of sanction for this.
So opponents, Corey, of this new law say it makes it more difficult to evaluate how the University of North Carolina system will respond to sex-related offenses because it shields them from scrutiny. Explain that argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think, these are public universities, and you if you were a student at one of these schools or you were sending your child to one of these schools, I think there's a feeling that you want to know that they'll be protected and that if they are a victim or survivor of sexual misconduct, that whoever, on their campus has done that will be held responsible or held accountable. And now there's no, I won't say no way, but there is less certainty that that is happening because there is less information being released about these cases.
Is that the intent, or is that just a misguided consequence of this?
I think that would probably depend on who you ask. I mean, UNC Chapel Hill, which was the basis of the Supreme Court case where all of this became public for years and years, was, criticized and, I believe investigated by the Department of Education or a department, some agency in the federal government for how they were handling these cases and that it was not, they were not doing it well. So I think if you take that into context, I think it's probably a mis an, an unfortunate consequence of this.
So 6 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled against the University of North Carolina system, and these records were being released, but not the victims' names. And now this new law reverses that. And in the interim, evidently, there have not been many incidences of survivor identities being released. So opponents say, Kate, that this, quote, further chips away at the state's public records law and adds a cloak of secrecy over cases that would otherwise be considered criminal and therefore public if they were not being handled by universities. So what was the impetus for this bill? What drove this bill through the legislature?
Do you mean what, caused lawmakers to support the
What was
bill?
the reason for it? And as you say, it was the first a standalone bill that didn't go anywhere. So somebody found it important to sneak it into or slip it into the budget bill. It has nothing to do with money. So somebody wanted this done. Why?
Well, Senator Michael Lee was a major supporter of the bill, as he was last year. And so, I think probably he was essential to kind of getting it into the bill. I will say I talked to the lobbyist who was sort of pushing this, Skye David, and she told me herself that last year she thinks the bill didn't make it very far because there could be political implications to the bill for people supporting it. So I do think it, being involved in the budget bill probably helped it a lot to get through. I don't know necessarily, we'll never really know what might have happened to the bill last year had it gone through, further through committees and so forth. But I do think it being in the budget helped, not bring so much attention to it.
Corey, you reported that the lawyer representing the Daily Tar Heel, the University Chapel Hill campus paper, and other media outlets insist that the legislation will prevent students from knowing if their classmates have been found responsible for misconduct or sexual assault. And since this directly impacts students, what have they had to say about this, either as pending legislation or now as law?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't heard a lot from students. I'll say last year I reported on a sexual misconduct case by a UNC basketball player, and UNC actually refused to release the information that I understood to be public record under the DTH versus Folt case. But Skye David was actually the survivor's attorney. And she makes the point that if a survivor of sexual misconduct on campus wants to share their story, that this law doesn't prevent them from doing it, that they could still come forward. They can share their name or be anonymous, or they can share the name of the perpetrator. So I think
But
some
doesn't that
people
mean
probably take.
but doesn't that mean yes, it protects the victim, but it also protects the perpetrator because you don't know who the perpetrator is. Isn't that at cross purposes?
That would be my view of it, but I think advocates see it differently.
So, Kate, you quote Pate McMichael, who's the director of the North Carolina Open Government Coalition, as saying North Carolina now joins many other states around the country in choosing secrecy and privacy over transparency and justice. And you quote media law attorney Hugh Stevens, who helped lead the initial complaint in 2020, as saying the law is consistent with the university's long history of trying to cover up or at least hide from public view proceedings like this. They don't like the publicity that goes with it. That's a quote. Is there a history of opaqueness within the UNC system? And if so, is it just over sexual misconduct, or does it extend to other aspects of the university system? Kate.
I would say, yes, you can definitely look and see that there has been a history of UNC in particular in sort of trying to keep things under wraps, I guess. I think UNC, out of all the UNC system schools, UNC definitely has the largest platform and draws the most attention.
You mean Chapel Hill?
Yes, yes. Chapel Hill definitely draws the most attention to itself, I think, and has the largest platform. So, you know, for some people might understand why they are a little more protective of certain information.
And once again, as you report and as we've discussed, when this was introduced as a separate bill, it did not get support, perhaps because, as you point out, of politics. It's an uncomfortable issue perhaps for politicians to want to talk about, and perhaps given what this does essentially to students and to parents inadvertently or indirectly, it's politically inexpedient for them to want to pass this bill. Instead, they slipped it into the budget. And even though it's in the budget and it's now law, isn't it still controversial? Isn't it still something that people don't want to talk about?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, Governor Josh Stein, when he signed the bill, he wasn't specifically referring to this necessarily, but he expressed that he was, you know, a little upset by some of the things that were put into the budget bill that really had nothing to do with the budget. And I think, you know, most people will see that this is one of those things.
So although it protects victims who maybe, at least in some people's view, did not need all that much protection because they hadn't been damaged much by the previous situation, it protects them. It also puts the onus on them to come forward to identify the perpetrators of sexual misconduct. With what's going on with gender politics in America, is that the intent?
I can't say for sure if that, I do believe that it seems like a very genuine effort to protect survivors. I personally wouldn't say that it seems to be coming from a place of malice.
Okay, when we come back, other things to talk about that are not related necessarily to the budget. Some of them are, but we'll talk about the controversy surrounding the Skill School. That's the School of Civic Life and Leadership in Chapel Hill. And about tuition changes that are all part of this budget situation. We'll do that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.org and WFAE 90.7 FM. We're here with Corey Dean, higher education reporter for the Assembly, and Kate Denning, education reporter for the Carolina Public Press, and looking into some of the things in the budget that deal with the University of North Carolina system and other aspects of higher education in the state. Earlier this year, Corey, there were some UNC Chapel Hill faculty members who expressed concern over the recently established School of Civic Life and Leadership, the so-called Skill School. Before we talk about that controversy, tell me what Skill is and why it was created.
Yes, so Skill, as you said, the School of Civic Life and Leadership, this was created 3 years ago now, I think. The stated purpose, I would say, is to teach civil discourse, civil dialogue, teach students how to debate each other and exchange ideas in a respectful way. It ran into some controversy pretty early on because Dave Bolick, who is now the state auditor, but at the time was chair of the UNC Board of Trustees, went on Fox News and said that the school was to remedy a shortage of right of center views among faculty and on campus. So I would say for most of its existence so far, there's been kind of this butting of heads, maybe of the stated purpose and what some people believe, you know, the quiet part that was said out loud.
Well, yes, if Dave Bolick, as then he was then the head of the Board of Governors at UNC, if he said it was to increase right of center views on campus, Should we not take him at his word?
Well, yeah, I think that that's a valid, fair point. I think that there has been an effort by the university to prove that it is not necessarily that. Interestingly, the school has kind of taken a somewhat religious turn, and a lot of the faculty or their research or scholarship is on religion and the Western civilization and those types of things. A lot of philosophy. So it's become an interesting example, I think, of these civic centers, civic education centers that are popping up around the country in kind of this vein of providing a center-right view of things.
Higher education in general, and UNC Chapel Hill in particular in North Carolina, have been viewed with a jaundiced eye by people on the right, saying that they're too liberal and they quash conservative points of view. Do they have a point? And is there anything intrinsically wrong with having a part of the university that encourages right of center views to be expressed and explored on campus?
That is a loaded question. I mean,
Yeah.
I think there have been studies done showing, probably a left lean to faculty across the country. I think generally universities say that they're open to a wide range of viewpoints, and especially we've seen over the past several years, universities really trying to actually foster that and to emphasize and require what they call viewpoint diversity, and to allow free speech and free expression. So, yeah, it's an
Well,
interesting time we're in.
yeah, this was positioned as a space for free speech. The school was positioned as a space for free speech, but critics have argued that all campus classrooms involve diversity of thought, and there are concerns that this school was created outside the typical faculty-led process, which makes it perhaps more or less, I guess, less fair than perhaps it would be if it were a normal situation. Have those fears proven to be true?
There has been a lot of interesting stuff going on at Skill. Like you said, it was not created in the typical vein that a normal school at UNC might be created. The faculty has had, I would say, a decent amount of infighting, and there have been disagreements about what the goal of the school is and how to accomplish that, and just the administrative side of who's in control and how much power they have. So,
Could it be argued that the School of Civic Life and Leadership that was established to increase right-of-center views and encourage free speech might want to change its focus, given the fact that discussions of diversity, equity, and inclusion are being absolutely stamped out? That's not free speech.
sorry, I don't know that I understand the question.
The question is, has the pendulum swung in the opposite direction to the point where certain things can no longer be discussed, or people's jobs are in peril as a result of bringing them up or encouraging that discussion in a classroom?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of, I think some people would say censorship, and a lot of also self-censoring. I mean, I think part of the impetus for Skill was that there was this belief that students were afraid to speak up in class or to share their opinion for fear of getting canceled or being recorded. What we're seeing now, though, amid the, crackdown on DEI is, professors in other states, Texas, comes to mind, being recorded for, teaching something about gender identity that maybe, and losing their job over that because it wasn't on their syllabus, is what the university says. So I just think that we're seeing this interesting blurring of lines between free speech and what that actually means and what it looks like in practice.
So, Kate, faculty and students have called for Chancellor Lee Roberts to release a report detailing a $1.2 million investigation into Skill. To date, that report has not been released. Why?
Well, the university says essentially that there's information in the report that is not subject to disclosure. I don't know how specific they've been about exactly what that information is. I think they've said that there's some accusations in there, basically discussion of, you know, faculty and personnel. That's their reasoning for not releasing the report in its entirety.
And the school, the Skills School, was established to, as we said, strengthen civic knowledge, civil discourse, and principled leadership. That's their description of that school. Values, they say, are essential to a thriving democracy, and they are not wrong about that. That is true. So could it be successfully argued that not releasing this report, being opaque about this report, is in direct opposition to that stated goal?
Well, we might find out the answer to that. A few news organizations, including the Assembly and Carolina Public Press, is suing the university to release this report, you know, on the basis that it should be subject to disclosure because it has been paid for by the public, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The recently passed budget also raises out-of-state tuition for NC Promise campuses like Western Carolina, UNC Pembroke, and Elizabeth City State. These are campuses where undergraduate tuition is capped at $500 per semester for in-state students. For out-of-state students, that cap was $2,500. Corey, what will it be now?
It will be, actually this upcoming year, it will be $3,500. That was through a mini budget bill that legislators passed, I think, last fall. But in the following year, 2027-28, it'll go up to $4,000 a semester.
So why are these schools designated as NC Promise campuses? What sets them apart?
Yeah, so this was an initiative started probably about a decade now. You know, I think probably some of the impetus had to do with raising enrollment and attracting students to these schools. If you think about Elizabeth City State, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was on the brink of closing. Legislators even proposed closing it because of, you know, enrollment and I think probably some financial issues. So, you know, I think the idea is offer free low tuition and, you know, invite students in. And it's been, I think, fairly successful. I mean, Elizabeth City State has really turned around. These other schools are seeing, you know, increases in enrollment. Fayetteville State is another NC Promise school that was added later. They've seen a lot of success in recent years.
So the cap for out-of-state students is rising by several thousand dollars. Ultimately, is the cap rising for in-state tuition at these schools?
It is not at these schools. Elsewhere okay. in the UNC system, pretty much every school will be raising in-state tuition for undergrads this upcoming fall.
So what will this increase in the cap for out-of-state students mean for these schools?
I think the idea, there's also this complex formula or, you know, equation of how all of this works that the legislature buys down or essentially pays the difference between the sticker tuition price and what this discounted price is. There's been some issues in recent years with actually enrollment at the Promise schools being higher than system officials projected. And then they're operating, you know, without all the money that they need, kind of similar to enrollment yeah. funding. So I think the idea is by having out-of-state students pay more, it kind of bulks up how much money they're bringing in. So maybe if there's that disconnect, it won't be as rough.
Do they anticipate fewer out-of-state students coming to those schools now as a result of this? Or is that just an insignificant amount of money when it comes to college?
That's a good question. I'm not for sure. I would assume that it's probably an insignificant amount. Yeah, I would assume it's an insignificant amount and really compared to what you would be paying an out-of-state tuition at any other UNC system school or really anywhere in the country. I mean, it's still a really good deal.
So, Kate, moving away from the budget but sticking with money for a second and higher education, let's talk about student loans. We know that many graduates are drowning in student loan debt, and to help alleviate that, the Biden administration successfully introduced the SAVE Act, the Saving on a Value Education Act. But the provisions of that bill officially ended as the result of the Trump administration's passage of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, and we just entered a 90-day period in which borrowers who were saving money with the SAVE Act have to make some decisions on selecting a plan. There are two plans to choose from under this new provision. What are they, and how do they differ from what is available, has been available under the SAVE Act?
Yeah, so we are in that 90-day period after July 1st where people who were on the SAVE plan now have to choose a new plan. About almost over 200,000 North Carolinians were on the SAVE plan. So the new repayment options are the tiered standard plan, which is a fixed amount that sort of you fall depending on, it had to be at least $50 a month, but it depending on how much you owe, you would fall in a different payment range essentially. And then the other is the income contingent repayment plan, or I'm sorry, the repayment assistance plan, which is income contingent.
And that requires monthly payments based on a percentage of income, I think, and the number of dependents that you have, but the payment would not be less than $10 a month. Given that some of this debt is enormous, it would take several lifetimes to pay it off at $10 a month. So are they forgiving part of this loan as a result if you choose that option?
I think the idea is that you're not necessarily paying only $10 a month. But
Okay.
no, I don't believe that that would be a forgiveness situation.
So how do the people, Corey, affected by this, who have to make these decisions, how do they do it? They have 90 days to do it, less than 90 days now, because it started, I think, July 1st. How do they know which plan to choose? Is there assistance available, or is it self-evident if you just take a look at what the requirements are?
I will admit that I'm not sure. As
Yeah, okay.
someone who's paying off student loans, even I don't know. Kate might know more than I do.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a one size fits all here. It seems like it's you're kind of on your own when it comes to choosing a new plan,
So
from what I hear.
you have until I think the end of September to make this decision. When does this actually go into effect? October the 1st?
Yeah, I believe it's pretty much immediate.
And some have said that aside from impacting current borrowers, the rollback of SAVE, the Biden program, might be a deterrent for students who want to go to college but who are concerned about what they might owe later on. Do we know what prospective students and their parents, Corey, are saying about this change? Have we heard anything about that?
I think it's an interesting time generally for student loans because at the same time that all of this is happening, there are also new limits being put on federal student loans, how much money you can actually borrow to pay for your education. And if you're going to a school that is quite expensive, I mean, we're seeing some schools pay, private schools specifically, charging about $100,000 a year in some cases. It becomes very difficult if you don't have savings to actually pay for this to think about how you're going to do
So we only have a couple of minutes left, and artificial intelligence has come up several times in this program. There is an artificial intelligence and social media safety bill progressing through the General Assembly with bipartisan support. House Bill 301 would change the current standards governing the use of AI in schools and mandating AI education for both students and educators. How would it change the standards, Kate?
Yeah, one of the things I had mentioned earlier is that computer science has been one of those fields really impacted by AI. And this is one of those instances where the legislature seems very aware of kind of these, things that are changing very quickly, and that's one of them. So one of the
Yeah.
things the bill, oh,
Go ahead. I'm
sorry.
sorry. No, go ahead.
One of the things the bill will do is update the computer science standards in high school, for high school and middle school, I believe, so that they might be more prepared for that field if they choose to enter it
Yeah,
in
interestingly
college.
enough, it appears that those with computer science degrees have one of the highest rates of unemployment at the moment, 7%. Computer engineering is even worse, 7.8%. And these are careers that just moments ago were deemed recession-proof. Is it all because of AI?
That is my interpretation. Yes, I think AI can do a lot of what computer scientists were, their pretty much entire jobs were, such as
Well, then
coding.
why in 2023 the legislature mandated a passing grade in computer science courses and they're revising the K through 12 computer science curriculum right now and more? Why? If these jobs are going away because of AI, why teach kids about it? I have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think they're trying to not necessarily sway people away from going into computer science, but just to be prepared for how computer science might look differently now that AI is here.
Okay. Kate Denny is an education reporter for Carolina Public Press. She was here along with Corey Dean, higher education reporter for The Assembly. Wow, changing times. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.